A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He watched a clip of a former prison officer talking about colleagues who came under death threats from inmates with organized crime connections on the outside. And it made him wonder about something most of us never think about. Who actually chooses this job? What motivates them? And how often does the danger follow them home to their families? It's a good question. We talk about prisons constantly in the abstract, but almost never about the people paid to be inside them every day.
That clip Daniel mentioned, it's not some rare horror story. There was a case just last year in California. A correctional officer's home was firebombed after a gang leader ordered the hit from inside the facility. The officer had been identified, his address got circulated, and the gang had people on the outside who carried it out. That's not an anomaly. That's the structure of the job in high-security settings.
The question sitting underneath Daniel's prompt is, what kind of person signs up for a career where your workplace is a building full of people who might want to kill you and your family, and where the public mostly doesn't care that you exist?
And I want to be precise about scope here. We're talking about high-security and maximum-security prisons in the U. This isn't about county jails holding people awaiting trial for misdemeanors. We're talking about facilities where inmates are serving long sentences, often for violent offenses, and where gang affiliations and organized crime connections are concentrated. That's where the threat dynamics Daniel's asking about really operate.
Let's start with the people behind the badge. Who becomes a correctional officer, and what drives them into this?
The demographics are actually pretty consistent across the research. The Bureau of Justice Statistics has tracked this for decades. The typical recruit is male, mid-30s, with some college education but no prior law enforcement experience. And here's the thing that surprises people. They're often not from cities. A lot of these facilities are in rural areas where the prison is the largest employer for 50 miles.
It's an economic decision first.
For many, yes. Job stability, benefits, a pension. In places where the manufacturing base collapsed or agriculture doesn't employ like it used to, a state or federal prison offers something rare, a paycheck that doesn't disappear. You get health insurance, retirement, and you don't need an advanced degree to qualify. That's a powerful draw.
Which is a very different recruitment picture from police work. Police departments tend to draw from the communities they serve. Prisons are often built in places far from where the inmates come from, and they recruit locally from those rural communities. So you've got officers who grew up in towns of 5,000 people, now managing populations drawn from urban gang environments. They have no personal framework for understanding.
And that cultural gap is part of what makes the job so psychologically disorienting. But let me push back on the purely economic framing, because the research shows it's more complicated. There was a study in the Journal of Correctional Healthcare in 2022 that found 40% of new officers cited helping people as a primary motivator. That's not a small number. Some officers genuinely believe in rehabilitation. They see themselves as part of something larger, maintaining order, yes, but also creating conditions where people can serve their time and come out better. Others are drawn from military backgrounds and see corrections as a continuation of service. It's a second-chance career for a lot of veterans.
I can see the appeal for someone leaving the military. Structured environment, clear chain of command, uniforms, the sense of mission. But I also wonder how many of those idealistic recruits last.
That's the right question. The attrition rates are brutal. The Federal Bureau of Prisons reported a 14% vacancy rate in 2025, and that's not just budget constraints, it's people washing out. Mandatory overtime means 12-hour shifts routinely stretched to 16 or even 24 hours. There was a strike by correctional officers in New York State in 2023 specifically over unsafe staffing levels, and officers testified about working full 24-hour shifts because there simply weren't enough people to relieve them.
24 hours awake in a maximum security prison. What kind of decisions are you making by hour 20?
And that's where the PTSD numbers come in. A RAND study in 2023 estimated PTSD rates among correctional officers at 30-40%. For context, combat veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan have reported PTSD rates in the 20-30% range. Correctional officers are experiencing trauma at rates comparable to or exceeding people who served in war zones.
Nobody's throwing them a parade.
Nobody's throwing them a parade. That's the difference with police work. Police officers have public visibility, union protections, and a cultural narrative that at least partially recognizes their sacrifice. Correctional officers work behind walls, literally and figuratively. The public doesn't see them. When people think about prisons, they think about inmates, either as threats to be contained or as victims of the system. The officer in the middle is invisible.
There's a stigma, right? The assumption that if you work in a prison, you must be some kind of sadist or a failed cop who couldn't get hired anywhere else.
That's one of the big misconceptions. The data doesn't support it at all. Most officers enter for stability and a sense of purpose. The failed police officer stereotype is just wrong. These are different career tracks with different recruitment pipelines, and the sadist assumption is even more damaging because it makes it harder for officers to seek mental health support. If you believe the public thinks you're a monster, you're not going to admit you're struggling.
What about the warden path? Is that different? Do wardens come from somewhere else?
A survey by the American Correctional Association in 2019 found that 85% of wardens started as line officers. These are people who spent 15 to 20 years working their way up through the ranks. They're not political appointees parachuted in from outside. They've done the job at every level.
The person running the facility has probably been threatened, probably been assaulted, probably worked the overnight shift for years. That's not a bureaucrat. That's someone who's been in it.
That matters for understanding how threats get handled. A warden who came up through the ranks knows exactly what an officer is facing when they report a threat. They've been there. The question is whether the institution gives them the resources to do anything about it.
Which brings us to the threat landscape. What does it actually look like when an inmate with organized crime connections decides to go after an officer?
It's not always violence. That's the first thing to understand. A 2021 report by the National Institute of Corrections found that 60% of officers in high-security facilities reported receiving a threat in the past year. And those threats take multiple forms. Direct verbal threats are the most common. I know where your family lives, that kind of thing. But then there's doxing. Inmates get access to contraband cell phones. It's a massive problem. And they can look up public records, find addresses, find names of spouses and children. Then they relay that information to associates on the outside.
Suddenly the officer's kid is named in a conversation they weren't part of.
That's psychological warfare. You don't have to touch someone to terrorize them. An inmate casually mentioning your daughter's school or your wife's commute, that's a threat. It says, we can reach you without saying anything prosecutable.
Then there's what they call paperwork threats.
Filing false complaints that trigger internal investigations. An inmate alleges excessive force or misconduct, and the officer gets pulled into a process that can last months. Even if the complaint is eventually dismissed, the officer spends that time under a cloud, possibly on administrative leave, possibly with pay suspended. It's a way to punish someone without lifting a finger.
For officers who resist corruption, who won't smuggle in contraband or look the other way, these threats escalate.
That's the dynamic Daniel's clip was getting at. The officer who won't play ball becomes a target, and the gang has resources. They have people on the outside who can act on information. The 2024 California firebombing case I mentioned earlier, that was a direct order from a gang leader inside the facility. He had the communication channels, he had the people, and he had the motivation. The officer had refused to cooperate with smuggling operations.
There was also the 2022 case in Texas. A correctional officer's family member was murdered in a targeted attack linked to an inmate's gang. The officer had been reporting threats for months. No relocation was offered. No meaningful protection was provided.
That gets to the institutional failure piece. The Federal Bureau of Prisons has a witness security program for staff. It's supposed to provide relocation and protection for officers facing credible threats. In 2025, they handled 12 cases. In the entire federal system, that's not because only 12 officers faced credible threats. It's because the program is underfunded, the threshold for qualifying is absurdly high, and the institutional culture discourages officers from even applying.
12 cases in a system that houses something like 150,000 federal inmates. That's not a program. That's a suggestion.
It's a press release that happens to have a phone number attached.
What does this do to someone psychologically? Living with the knowledge that your job might get your family hurt.
The research paints a grim picture. Hypervigilance becomes a baseline state. You're scanning for threats at work, then you come home, and you're still scanning. Officers report being unable to sit with their back to a door in a restaurant. They take different routes home every day. They don't tell their spouses details about work because they don't want to spread the fear, which then isolates them inside their own marriages.
The divorce rates track that.
A 2020 study in criminal justice and behavior found correctional officer divorce rates 50% higher than the national average. You combine the stress, the secrecy, the overtime that means you're never home, the emotional numbing that comes from the job, marriages don't survive that at the same rate.
There's also the thing nobody talks about, which is what the job does to your ability to trust people. If you spend 40 hours a week in an environment where manipulation is constant, where kindness is often a setup, where every interaction has a hidden layer, how do you come home and just be normal with your kids?
You don't. Or you learn to compartmentalize so aggressively that you become a different person at home and your family notices the split. There's a whole literature on correctional officer personality, not as a type of person who enters the field, but as an adaptation to the environment. People become suspicious, emotionally guarded, authoritarian in their personal relationships. It's an occupational hazard that follows you into every other part of your life.
The public conversation about prisons never includes any of this.
Because the public conversation about prisons is stuck in a binary. Either prisons are too harsh and we need reform, or prisons are too soft and we need more punishment. Both sides are arguing about what inmates deserve. Nobody's talking about what officers endure. And when officers do speak up, like the strike in New York, the coverage frames it as a labor dispute, not as a crisis of human sustainability.
Let me ask you something. Given everything we've just laid out, the PTSD rates, the threats, the divorce statistics, the public indifference, why does anyone stay?
That's the question, isn't it? Some stay because they feel trapped. They're mid-career, they've got a pension accruing, and the skills don't transfer obviously to other fields. Others stay because of the camaraderie. The officer culture in these facilities is intense. You're going through something together that nobody outside understands, and that creates bonds.
Like combat units.
And some stay because they believe in the mission. They've seen inmates turn their lives around. They've been part of that. They believe that if good people leave, the institutions get worse, and that matters for public safety.
What do we actually do about any of this? What's actionable?
Let me give two angles. First, for someone considering the career, and people do still consider it, you need to go in with your eyes open. During the hiring process, ask specifically about threat assessment protocols. Ask how many threat cases the facility handled last year and what the outcomes were. Ask about psychological support resources, not just whether they exist, but how many officers actually use them without career repercussions.
Because a counseling program that nobody uses, because using it gets you labeled as unfit, is worse than no program at all.
The stigma around mental health and corrections is severe. Officers fear that admitting to PTSD or anxiety will cost them promotions, or get them assigned to desk duty or mark them as a liability, so they suffer in silence. A facility that's serious about officer wellness has to address that cultural barrier, not just offer an employee assistance hotline.
The second angle.
The 2025 reauthorization debate around the First Step Act included provisions for officer wellness, mental health funding, threat mitigation resources, staffing minimums to reduce mandatory overtime. Those provisions matter. This isn't just a labor issue, it's a public safety issue. An officer who's been awake for 20 hours, who's terrified for their family, who's suffering from untreated PTSD, that officer is not making good decisions. And in a maximum security environment, bad decisions get people hurt.
Funding officer wellness isn't charity, it's harm reduction.
And there's a transparency piece too. Prison staffing data should be publicly available. Vacancy rates, overtime hours, assault statistics, threat reports. Sunlight makes it harder for administrators to hide problems and easier for legislators to justify funding.
There are organizations pushing for this. The National Correctional Officers Association has been advocating for better conditions and more transparency. They're not a household name, but they're doing the work.
They're under-resourced compared to police unions, which is part of the broader asymmetry. Police have political power. Correctional officers don't. They're not a voting bloc anyone's afraid of.
Where does this go from here? Prison populations are declining in some states. California's been downsizing. New York has closed facilities. Does a smaller prison population change the threat landscape?
It might actually concentrate the risk. When you close facilities, you consolidate populations. The inmates who remain in high-security settings are the ones with the longest sentences and the most serious offenses. Gang influence doesn't disappear just because the total number of inmates goes down, so you could end up with fewer officers guarding a more concentrated population of high-risk inmates.
The problem gets more intense even as the system shrinks.
There's also the technology angle. AI monitoring systems are being deployed in some facilities, cameras that can detect unusual movement patterns, algorithms that flag potential threats based on inmate communications. Biometric access controls could reduce the risk of officers' personal information leaking, but that raises its own privacy concerns.
For the officers?
For the officers. If every interaction is recorded and analyzed, if your movements are tracked, if your communications are monitored, that's a surveillance burden on top of everything else. And there's the question of whether the data gets used to protect officers or to discipline them.
The same system that flags a threat against an officer could also flag that officer for taking an extra 5 minutes on a break. The panopticon cuts both ways.
That's the tension that runs through all of this. The job is fundamentally about control, controlling a population that doesn't want to be controlled, in an environment where violence is always a possibility. But the people doing the controlling are also being controlled by the institution and by the threat environment. They're caught in the middle of a system that needs them but doesn't value them.
Daniel's question was about who does this work and what they face. I think the answer is ordinary people who took a job for stability found themselves in an invisible war and are largely left to fight it alone.
The threats that follow them home aren't a bug in the system. They're a feature of what incarceration looks like when organized crime is involved. As long as inmates can communicate with the outside world, and they can, and they will, officers will be vulnerable. The question is whether we build institutions that protect them or leave them exposed.
One thing I keep coming back to. We've talked about the psychological toll, the threats, the institutional failures. But there's also something almost absurd about the whole arrangement. We take people from small towns, put them in buildings with members of criminal organizations, pay them modestly, work them to exhaustion, and then act surprised when things go wrong.
The surprise is the most telling part. Every few years, there's a case that makes headlines. An officer's family attacked, a corruption scandal, a riot, and the coverage treats it like a shocking anomaly. But if you look at the numbers we discussed, the 60% threat rate, the PTSD prevalence, the staffing crisis, it's clear these aren't anomalies. They're the predictable output of a system designed without officer welfare as a priority.
The officers who stay, who keep showing up, there's something there that deserves more respect than they get.
I think that's right. Whatever you think about prisons as an institution, and reasonable people disagree about that, the individuals working inside them are doing something most of us would not sign up for. They deserve a public conversation that actually acknowledges their reality.
For anyone listening who's considering this career, go in informed. Ask the hard questions during hiring. Know what support is actually available, not just what's listed in the brochure. And for everyone else, pay attention to the staffing and wellness provisions in criminal justice legislation. It's not the most exciting part of the debate, but it's where the human cost lives.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a researcher isolated a strain of cheese-ripening bacteria from a single surviving wheel of queso fresco found in an abandoned mining camp in Chile's Atacama Desert. The bacterium, Brabibacterium atacamense, produces a compound that gives the cheese a distinct earthy flavor found in no other known cheese culture, and the original isolate remains the only known source. All commercial descendants trace back to that one wheel.
Somewhere there's a lineage of cheese that descends from a single survivor in a desert ghost town.
Cheese with a pedigree. I respect that.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.